Support for this podcast is made possible in part by our members. Become a member of WNTI by visiting our ePledge page at WNTI.org.
You're listening to Contours, WNTI's Issues and Arts program. Now your host, Melanie Teal.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Contours. Today on the show, Bill Nutt interviews Andrew Compton about the anniversary of the invasion of Normandy. We'll also hear the Astro update for June. Public health planner. We'll hear about the Warren County Department of Health. And first up, Bill Nutt's going to tell us about some fun stuff that's happening in Morris County. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
It bears repeating. The 4th of July is more than just barbecues, picnics, fireworks, ball games, and concerts. And we here in New Jersey should be especially cognizant of our place in the history of our country. New Jersey, the cockpit of the American Revolution, site of, among other events, the Battle of Monmouth, the Battle of Trenton, Washington's crossing of the Delaware, and the Jockey Hollow encampment. Well, the Morris County Tourism Bureau is doing their best to make sure that New Jerseyans are aware of that history. And one of the ways they do that is through an event called Revolutionary Times, which will take place the weekend of July 3rd through the 5th at Morristown National Historical Park. With us on the other end of the line is Carol Barkin, Outreach Manager for the Morris County Tourism Bureau. It is a pleasure for me to say, Carol, welcome to the WNTI airwaves.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Oh, it is my pleasure, believe me. Why don't we start by talking about this year's event? When people go to the National Historical Park in Morristown the weekend of July 3rd through the 5th, what are they going to see? What are they going to hear?
Well, first of all, they've graciously opened the park for the entire weekend free to the public. It'll be open each day from 9:30 till 5 o'clock. So what a great opportunity if you haven't been or you haven't been since the fourth grade when your teacher took you there. It's a great opportunity to go back to the park and reacquaint yourself with the story. On July 3rd, which is actually when the national holiday is celebrated, they're opening their lawn, people to bring chairs and blankets and hear a free concert at 2 p.m. by the fife and drums of the old barracks. They're coming up from Trenton, and it's all patriotic music, and that event is free. On July 4th, we're going to do what I think is the most authentic way to celebrate the holiday. We're going to be inside the Presbyterian Church on the Green, 57 East Park Place at noon for the public reading of the Declaration of Independence. We'll have costume interpreters on hand. We'll ask the people in the church, our guests, to pretend they're patriotic colonists, and there'll be sort of an interactive reading of the Declaration of Independence. And that'll quickly be followed by the feu de joie, which is a musket salute. We won't do that in the church. We'll move outside for that.
Good idea.
Yeah, and then we'll move to the green where there'll be arts and crafts and music. And a highlight this year is a ceremony at 1:30. It's Welcome Home Veterans. It's welcoming all veterans from all wars, a special ceremony around the Gold Star Mother's Tree, which sits on the Morristown Green. And all those activities will be from about 11 till 2 on July 4th. And then on July 5th, we're promoting some activities of our partners, some local historical and cultural sites, which are offering programming. So there's, you know, it's great if you can go to the shore, but if you're going to stay home, there's plenty to do in Morristown that weekend.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that in recent years, the Morristown National Historical Park has kind of gone out of its way to promote this history. Am I correct in saying that? That's a relatively recent development.
I don't think I agree with you. I mean, the park was established in 1933, the nation's first national historical park. They built that museum as one of the first museums ever to be built by the National Park Service. And specifically, their mission is to continue to educate the public and provide interpretation of the two winter encampments. And they're all about the American struggle for independence, and that's a story. I mean, 300,000 people come to the park every year to hear that story.
Wow. That's great. The Revolutionary Times event, though, is that a relatively recent development, or have you always celebrated the 4th of July, of
course.
Right.
I would say that we've upped our game maybe the last 4 years with Revolutionary Times and a closer partnership between the Tourism Bureau and the National Park. But the tradition of the public reading of the Declaration of Independence, I think that's gone on every year.
Really?
Since the Continental Army left.
Wow. Wow, that's great. That's great. I guess I was conflating the Revolutionary Times, which I knew was a relatively recent thing, as you mentioned. That's the past 4 years in particular.
Yeah, the only difference is it was happening at the Ford Mansion, and when we moved it to the Green, the Morristown Green, we were able to accommodate many more people. I think they always had about 400 people who would come to the National Park for the reading. Last year we had 800. We had to move it indoors. And the year before we had, I'd say, 1,200 people on the Morristown Green.
Wow.
We had fair weather.
Wow, that's always good. We are talking with Carol Barkin, the outreach manager of the Morris County Tourism Bureau. Carol, what do you find that people don't get about Morris County and Northern New Jersey's place in history? What are you trying to make people more aware of?
Well, I think that we're so much more than the Revolution. I think we have about 30 cultural and historical sites that are well worth a visit. We want to get that message across to visitors. I'm just looking at our maps. We've had visitors from, I would say, 6 continents already this year, and probably 30 states who find us, you know, just 30 miles west of New York. Universally, they think it's a charming area. And I think you'd be surprised to know we've had nearly 1 million visitors to the area, pumping about $2 billion into the local economy from tourism expenditures.
Wow.
So we're sort of like the little engine that could. We're not the biggest county, but I think we have a tremendous amount to offer.
The I'm kind of concentrating on the Revolutionary Times event. How has that changed over the past few years, or has it changed other than the perhaps expansion of attendees?
I find that people are putting it on their calendars. Just anecdotally, I met a couple. They come out from New York every year on July 4th, heading out to their summer place in Pennsylvania, and they make it a point of stopping in Morristown to hear the Declaration of Independence read.
Wow.
And, you know, we just want to provide a good alternative and an authentic experience for people as well. Like you said at the beginning, it's more than fireworks. It's more than picnics. You don't want the meaning of the holiday lost. And so we give people an opportunity to sort of be in touch with the real story of American independence.
Is there anything in the works? Obviously, our focus is on Revolutionary Times, the weekend of July 3rd to the 5th. What else is coming up this summer that you at the Morris County Tourism Bureau would like to let our listeners know about?
Well, we just finished our spring series of original walking tours, and we will start our summer historical walking tour series on July 18th. And we're going to just quickly review the topics. The Morristown Green began appearing on maps in 1715, so we're going to do a tour on the Green,
wow,
which has been the center of life in the town and the most important real estate in town for 300 years, and that's July 18th. And then we're going to be talking about historic preservation at Historic Speedwell, one of our 4 national historic landmarks,
mm-hmm,
the place where the telegraph was invented and perfected. Then we're going to be talking about Morris Township, our neighboring town, which is celebrating a 275th anniversary, and we have an exhibit on display at our local library. And the members of the Morris Township Historic Preservation Commission are going to be on hand to guide people through that exhibit. Then on Saturday, August 8th, the Morristown Church Architecture Tour. This is a town of spires and towers, and some of our most beautiful architecture exists in these churches. So we'll go to about seven of them, maybe go into three of the interiors on August 8th. And then on August 15th, this is really special. We've never done this before. We're partnering again with Morristown National Historical Park. And the curator, Dr. Jude Pfister, is going to give us a backstage, behind the ropes opportunity to go into the archives. And the archives have so much more material beyond the two winter encampments. In fact, the 500,000 objects in the collection date from about 15,000 BC to the 20th century. And our tour participants are going to have an opportunity to request certain things from the curator, and we'll be able to be sort of an interactive tour as well.
That's very exciting. And you've mentioned the encampments a couple times, and I'm not sure if our listeners know that the encampment at Jockey Hollow, a lot of people think about Valley Forge and Washington kneeling in the snow and praying, but the encampment at Jockey Hollow was an even more grueling winter, and in many ways helped forge the Continental Army to the fighting force that it became. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah, we like to think in Morristown that it was a turning point, that Washington, through very difficult conditions that winter, was able to keep the Army together. It would have been very easily for them to have just walked away when their terms were up on December 31st. But he imbued them with this idea that they were fighting for something much bigger than themselves, and they stayed. They stayed in Morristown, 10,000 of them. The worst winter in memory. There were 28 snowstorms, and supply lines were cut off, and as you know, they didn't get their food and their supplies, and it's amazing that so few people died, actually, that winter. But, yeah, I was able to keep the Army together. Now, there was no fighting that took place in Morris County, but at one point, a group of militiamen did run to Springfield. The British never made it this west into New Jersey.
Wow. Talking with Carol Barkin of the Morris County Tourism Bureau. Carol, one last question before we go, and I guess this is kind of more of a from your perspective. What would you like to see happen with Revolutionary Times in the years to come?
I think that we've expanded it from 1 to 3 days this year. We try and create a program that's interesting and diverse for lots of different people. I'm excited that we have as many partners as we do this year and sponsors. My hope would be that more and more people take advantage of the things we're offering and really stop and think in their busy daily lives about what it means to be an American and what it means to be from Morris County and become educated about our contributions.
We've been talking with Carol Barkin of the Morris County Tourism Bureau. And to remind you again, the National Historical Park is partnering with the Morris County Tourism Bureau to present Revolutionary Times, a weekend celebration, free to the public, July 3rd through the 5th, mainly centered in the Morristown area. For more information, where can people go? And is there a phone number that people can...
Consult our website, morristourism.org, and our phone number, we're here Monday through Friday, 9 to 4, is 973-631-5151.
Carol, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us here. And what can I say except happy Independence Day, and I hope it's as meaningful for you as it is that you're trying to create for the rest of us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for helping us get the word out.
For Contours and for WNTI, this has been Bill Nutt.
Bellagiorno Catering, located on Route 46 in Belvedere, New Jersey. Bellagiorno is a banquet hall that can host private parties, family gatherings, business, corporate events, and classic weddings. Off-premises catering is also available. More information on Bellagiorno available online at bellagiornocatering.com or by phone 908-475-0084.
Sword, Juno, Gold, Omaha, and Utah are names that don't seem to have any connection to each other. But they have a definite and historic connection. They are locations where history was changed from a world of dictatorship to one of freedom. All people should know that these locations were the beaches of Normandy, where the Allies began the invasion of the Nazis in Europe on the shores of northern France. The 71st anniversary of this enormous historic event was this past Saturday, so we should all be aware of this monumentous event. We should all know about the tremendous sacrifices that were made by our brave soldiers freeing the world from Nazism. So today we have as our guest our World War II historian, Andrew Compton. Welcome again to our program Contours, Andy.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate the accolades. I am an amateur historian and devotee of what happened because it was the biggest thing that happened in my lifetime.
Well, your knowledge of this time in history is at the level of some of the professional historians.
It's almost annoying. Well, maybe it is annoying, depending on who you talk to.
So why don't you tell us about those four beaches?
The four beaches were, if you could be in a hot air balloon at 5,000 feet in eastern or northwestern France, looking across the channel toward England, to your immediate right was Sword Beach, Juno Beach, and Gold Beach. They were the Canadian and British beaches. To the west, the left, was our Omaha and Utah. Everybody knows about Omaha. It was a true bloodbath.
That was our beach, right?
We had two beaches, Omaha and Utah.
Oh, okay.
And I would strongly recommend people to see the first half of a movie called Saving Private Ryan, done by Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg. It came out about 7 or 8 years ago.
Now,
and it will give. How many war movies can you watch? You know, I saw a preview of it in an interview of two vets who waded ashore that morning, and those two vets, after seeing that clip, said, "That's exactly what it was."
Hmm.
It is, in one word, frightening. Horrific. What happened there. The number of people who lost their lives from either being hit or drowned or whatever. And the far western end is Utah Beach, which in fact was probably best described as an airborne beach, because our 82nd and 101st Airborne troops went in there and landed behind the lines and prevented the Germans from getting up to the beach to stop us all the way across, because there were a number of what was described as a draw, D-R-A-W, a draw. You might want to call it a gully.
Hmm.
There were a large number of gullies that ran from inland to the beach, through which the Germans could bring reinforcements. 82nd was the far wester. The 101st was closer toward Omaha, and their job was to hold those draws open until the troops could be landed. What we have to remember, and a lot of people forget this, or don't know it, I should say, why did we do this? What was going on here? Our intention was to run from the beach to Berlin, to the Reichstag, and capture Hitler.
Hmm.
We had to get there somehow. Here was the place to start it. We had succeeded in snookering Hitler into thinking that we were coming ashore at Calais, which is about 60 miles away, the closest to the English coast, 21 or 22 miles. That was where we convinced them through our friend Garbo, who was a double agent. We turned the Brits and the Americans turned him 2 years prior to the invasion, and we fed the Germans a steady line of baloney into thinking that we were coming ashore in Calais.
Why were these four beaches selected, Andy?
It's the only place. It was the only place that was the least fortified of the whole French coast.
So the hardest place to invade, actually, huh?
Well, the hardest place to invade would have been up by Calais, because it was all hardened fortifications and coastal guns and 8 and 12-inch batteries that would just destroy naval force. The least, what should we call it, dangerous, if you want to say that, were these beaches. And if you could, in your mind's eye, if you have ever been to the New Jersey coast, the Sword, Juno, and Gold Coast beaches look a great deal like the New Jersey shore. If you were to stand with your ankles in the water and look at the inland side with the houses and everything all along the beachfront, that's what that looked like. There were no hills to speak of in those three low-lying beaches. It was all resorts, all vacation spots. And that's where the Brits and the Canadians landed.
Who were the first to invade, by the way?
First to invade was the 6th Parachute Division of the Brits. They landed, I guess, about 2 o'clock in the morning via glider to shut down one end of the beach thrust. They landed in a place called Ranville, R-A-N-V-I-L-L-E, which was east of Cannes and Ouistreham. They landed by glider, and their job was to shut down the crossings of the Orne River and the Cannes Canal, two pieces of water side by side, 300 yards apart. They landed there with Horsa gliders, with about 25 guys in each glider. About 6 or 8 of them went in there. The first casualty of the war was a young enlisted man who unfortunately banged his head and drowned. He wasn't shot. The first Allied casualty, I guess, was Len Botham. He died on the bridge. Long and short of it is, and we won't dwell on this, is the Brits were able to shut off access to our beaches from that angle so that the Germans could not reinforce. And they grabbed the bridges over the Orne River and the Cannes Canal, and they are now called Pegasus Bridge.
Ah, okay. There was a movie made about that recently.
Yes, there was. Colonel Howard was the leader of that group, played by an actor whose name at this very second escapes me, who in fact was there.
Oh, really?
On the bridge.
Okay.
Pulling the trigger. He was fighting it. And they shut that down at the foot of the Cannes Canal. Is a place, a coffee shop that was owned by the same family that owns it now. All these years, 75 years, all in, they own that. It's the Gondry family, and that the shop is still there. I've been to that shop. I have had a Coca-Cola at that shop,
okay.
And it's really a piece of history to walk in that door and order a soda, you know, at that exact place where they anchored it. They literally anchored that end of the beachfront. Going further west was a bit of a mess. The Brits and the Canadians got chopped up pretty good. I think Gold was the least of the mess. Omaha was the worst. Omaha had cliffs and bluffs.
That had to be
taken. These cliffs and bluffs in stone with fortifications had to be taken with the pillboxes and the gun placements and had to be taken individually. Our destroyer fleet was in large part responsible for taking out a lot of them. The destroyers got so close to the beach that their propellers were spinning mud in their effort to get accurate shots on the pillboxes.
I was going
to
ask you, before the actual invasion of the troops, was there much shelling going on?
A lot of shelling, a lot of bombing.
Vessels?
There was a hell of a blue.
Aircraft bombing.
A lot of aircraft bombing. Yeah. Unfortunately, the aircraft bombing during the event was delayed in their release so that they wouldn't hit the troops. And unfortunately, that 20-second or 30-second release delay made them drop bombs 5-6 miles away. So it was ineffective, the aerial bombing. Lancasters and Flying Fortresses and B-24s, it didn't really work. Mm. We owned the skies in western France, so there was no fear of the Luftwaffe coming in. Yeah, a couple of them came by and squirted the beach. There are some photographs of that happening, but we owned the skies, so there was no fear there.
Which of the beaches was taken first?
Huh. That's hard to say. It was a simultaneous effort. Everybody coming ashore.
Yeah, it could be happening at the same time.
It was a hell of a noise. Sure. There were over 160,000 people involved in the assault. It's called Operation Normandy. It's not Overlord. Overlord was the whole thing. Operation Normandy was the specific landing.
Oh, okay. How long did it take before they established any kind of beachhead for themselves?
The beachhead was basically established by noontime.
And they began when?
They began it depending on what you were doing. If you were in the airborne troops, you were in at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Right? The beach landings began at dawn and came ashore, from sunup, so where people could see what the hell they were doing.
As I understand it, they had all kinds of different sort of obstacles that the Germans had put in the way of the invasion.
Everything you can imagine.
How did they get?
They had railroad ties.
Past all that.
Through horrific effort.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Horrific effort. The frogmen, the UDT as they were called, which are now called SEALs, went in first in an attempt to blow up the obstacles right on the beaches, right in the wash, right at the water's edge, so that the landing craft could come in. On these obstacles, and they are railroad tracks, if you can picture it, crisscrossed and welded together, on which were fixed something called a teller mine, T-E-L-L-E-R. And if you hit a teller mine, you were a red mist. There was nothing left of you, and that was when the landing craft, the LSTs and the Higgins boats, hit those things. It just destroyed them completely.
So those landing craft really couldn't come in very close to the shore to drop the troops off.
If I misled you a little bit about if you could imagine the New Jersey shore, the widest part of the New Jersey shore down to Long Beach Island is maybe 200 yards, maybe. Hmm. Maybe. How about trying 800 yards of flat beach, shallow water that these boys had to cross?
Hmm.
Wading, walking with 50, 60, 80 pounds worth of equipment on their backs.
Because the boats
couldn't.
In a
withering crossfire of machine guns and artillery. So they had one hell of a long walk to get.
To get to any
kind of cover.
That's because the boats couldn't get in close enough.
The water was knee-deep, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So these boys were having to jump off these landing craft and literally walk 500 yards.
Now, we were talking before this, and you said that one of the most important things to consider in any kind of attempt in an invasion of this nature was the idea of supplying the troops with what they needed. Well, how did that take place?
If you think of the scope of what was happening here, we were landing on the beaches of the English Channel in Normandy, and we wanted to get to the Reichstag in Berlin. How the hell do you get there?
Yeah.
You've got a hell of a long supply chain to create. So the thrust of the landings, besides establishing a foothold on the beach, was to get around the corner, so to speak, of the Cotentin Peninsula. The Cotentin Peninsula, they had to get through a little town called Bayeux, They had to get through past a little town called Carentan. Then they had to swing northwest to go up the Cotentin Peninsula to Cherbourg to establish control of that port, a deep water port, and through which we could bring our supplies. Well, the problem is the Germans didn't want to give it up. And in fact, it took probably 3.5 weeks or so to get to Cherbourg. Meanwhile, the Germans destroyed it. They completely wrecked the port. I guess I don't blame them. You know. So what we established as a means of getting equipment onto the beach, because we had a long way to go to Berlin. We were not able to get Antwerp up the beach and inland. We weren't able to get Antwerp until the middle of October. This is early June. So we had to establish something called beach access to bring across supplies. The British devised something called a mulberry. They devised something called a mulberry, which was a gigantic caisson. They had to be 50 yards long, seemingly. 50 yards long.
What's a caisson?
Huge block. A floating block.
Okay.
The Brits built on the English side of the channel and floated across the channel and sunk just off the beaches of Gold Sword, Juno, and for that matter, our beaches as well. They were called mulberries. And from the mulberries, they were able to establish a floating road, and they brought a whole bunch of older ships over and sunk them to create a breakwater around the beaches at Gold and Juno. They did it at Omaha and Utah as well, mostly Omaha. However, if you were able to get to Arromanches on the coast, there is a fantastic museum with a diorama in it showing a moving diorama showing the ebb and flow of water and these huge caissons, these mulberries floating out there. 10 days later, there was the worst storm in decades hit the English Channel and completely destroyed half of the American mulberries, just wiped it out. They had partial use of one of them to bring supplies across. The Brits made that a little bit better. They were able to keep theirs open. These mulberries on the British beaches are still there.
Uh-huh.
They're still there. There are immense structures. And if you can get to the Arromanches Museum, it's very much worth your while. And there's a nice restaurant across the street.
We're talking to Andrew Compton. He's a World War II historian that we've had on the program before. And in commemoration of the 71st anniversary of the Allied landing on the beaches of Normandy in northern France to establish beachheads against the Nazis who occupied that area. Maybe let's go back a few steps in terms of the final implementation of the invasion of those beaches. The invasion didn't take place, as I understand it, on the date and the time when it was originally planned because of weather conditions.
No. The window of opportunity was June 4th through the 6th. I think it was June 4th through the 6th. Maybe may have included the 7th. And the landing day was the 5th of June. So on the 4th, the paratroopers were all lined up to get on their airplanes at 11 o'clock in the evening. The boats were all loaded. Remember, the English Channel, in many cases, was 100 miles wide. I have traveled the channel from Portsmouth to Wistreham. It took 7 hours in a modern ferry moving along pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So in many cases, these boys had to travel 100 miles in an LST, getting their brains beaten out. Storm came up on the 4th. They were leaving to land on the 5th. They got offshore partway over, and Schaeff blew the whistle and said, come home. Come back. They brought them all back. What a mess.
I can imagine.
What a mess.
Regroup again, huh?
Regroup, refuel, get everybody off the ship, wipe off the puke, Yeah. You know, I mean, they just got slammed out there. And they went off again on the night of the 5th and were successful in crossing the channel. And the rest of it's kind of history. That's kind of trite, but it was a hell of a trip. Again, in many cases, over 100 miles.
Hmm. Now, considering the waves of soldiers that came in during the invasion, in terms of the commandos, the paratroopers, and the soldiers that came ashore on the boats, what sequence did it take in terms of who came in first and who was next and so on and so forth?
Well, the first people on the ground was the 6th paras of the Brits. They were up in Ranville when they shut off that corner of the beach. They were the first ones on the ground. And the first building to be liberated was the Gondry coffee shop at Pegasus Bridge. That was the first building to be liberated, literally. The first town to be liberated was the town of Bayeux further on down the coast, which is, I strongly recommend you go and visit. Bayeux is a wonderful, wonderful little town. Also the home of the Bayeux Tapestries, which is worth a half a day of your life.
Showing what, the Normandy invasion way back during...
The first one going the other way. Yeah, William the Conqueror, which is a fantastic, fantastic thing. Bayeux Tapestries, when I was there, I was looking for a rug hanging on a wall, and it's not. It's an 18-inch tall linen, 180 feet long embroidery of the invasion of William the Conqueror in 1066. The cathedral in Bayeux was consecrated, I think, in 1056. Of course, it was only a shack when they consecrated it. It is now... You know, over the centuries from then, has been stunning, stunning cathedral.
So you would say the paratroopers came first then?
Paratroopers basically went in first. Again, their job was to shut down those draws that would allow reinforcements to the Germans by the Germans to the beach to prevent us from coming over. And the weather was so terrible, the drops were just all over the place.
So they weren't landing where they were supposed to land?
In many cases... 15 miles away. You know, it was just horrific. And when they came across from Eupatory, in the case of the 101st, they went west around the Channel Islands, which is Jersey, Guernsey, and Sark, and then they came around northeast to come in from the mainland, from the French side, before they dropped their people.
Andy, we've come to an end of the interview already.
Oh, my God.
We haven't even
got... Oh, my God. We barely got started.
I know.
I didn't even talk about Pluto. I'm going to talk about Pluto.
Well, we can save that for next time, maybe.
We can do whatever you want, Carl.
We'll have to do that because...
Pluto, by the way, was pipeline under the ocean.
They're not thinking astronomy at this point.
No, it's not. No. Or Daffy Duck.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'll be happy to do it again if you wish.
Great. We've been talking to... Andrew Compton, who is a World War II historian, and he's being interviewed and has been in the past about the invasion of the Normandy beaches and the movement of our soldiers into Germany, headed for Berlin and Hitler.
And we didn't even get a chance to talk about our New Jersey native, Sergeant Leonard Lomel from Toms River, New Jersey. We never got to talk about him.
Okay, well,
we'll talk about him. He was a hell of a guy.
So we'll catch him next time.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. I'd be happy to do it anytime.
WNTI Stage is celebrating its 5th anniversary this year, July 17th, 18th, and 19th at the Knowlton Lions Club Pavilion, with a lineup that you won't want to miss. But the event can't happen without the generous help of community volunteers. If you would like to get close to the action, why not become a member of our street team? Positions available include gate sales, parking, and site prep. More information and details by contacting Melanie Teal at 908-979-4355 extension 1 or wntistage.org. Sarah Shoemaker is joining me this morning on Contours. She's from the Warren County Health Department, and she's the public health planner and also a listener of WNTI. I'll throw that in as well. But we are here today to talk about something very interesting that's happening in Warren County as far as the health department is concerned. And I think the listeners will find it just as interesting as I do, because
thank you very much. We have a grant.
Yes, we have a grant. So at the health department, we're obviously concerned about the health of the citizens of Warren County, many of whom are probably WNTI listeners, which is great. So I hope they get to hear about this program. And we are responsible for doing an assessment of the health of Warren County every 5 years. So we conduct some surveys and look at the data and see what's going on. And we identify priority areas when we do this assessment and decide what kind of strategies we're going to use to address these identified areas. So this year, probably it comes as no surprise to most people that obesity is a common problem across the United States, and is a problem also in Warren County. Approximately 66, two-thirds of people of our residents in Warren County are overweight or obese. And so we decided that that's a pretty big problem. And we just want to do something about it. And it's our responsibility at the health department to address that. So earlier this year, or late last year, colleagues from the Rutgers Cooperative Extension, which is a nonprofit arm of Rutgers University that works throughout the state of New Jersey, approached me about applying for a grant called the Shaping New Jersey Healthy Communities Grant. So we put together this proposal with some strategies to work on obesity prevention in the county. And we're happy to announce that we were awarded this grant, and we came up with this great program called Choose Healthy Warren County.
So, I like the name.
Thank you. So there are a couple of things that are going to be going on with this Choose Healthy Warren County program throughout the summer and throughout the rest of the year that you can look forward to. And I'm going to be back here at WNTI to talk about the other parts of our program. But today I want to talk about our initiative with the restaurants that we have in Hackettstown. So we're very excited about that. The Choose Healthy program, we are working with the independently owned restaurants in Hackettstown, which is a pretty exciting thing. Jim Sheldon at the Hackettstown Bid has been very helpful in getting me and our colleagues in touch with the restaurant owners of Hackettstown, and the reception from them has been exceptional. As of right now, we have 10 restaurants on board. They include restaurants like Stella G's, the Pan Am Room, Topo, Mama's, Marley's Gotham Grill, Zayton, that's down on Schooley's Mountain Road, the Pump House, I think, is participating, B. McNally's, Mezza House, Prickly Pear, and Enzo's, and the health food store that's even across the street from Stella G's are all participating. And what this program entails, it's pretty cool. So we are working with a nutritionist from Rutgers Cooperative Extension. So she's actually a professor at Rutgers. And we have some software which we use to analyze the nutritional content of the restaurant meals. So we asked our restaurants to send us a copy of their menu, and then we take a look at it and quickly decide, these menu items look already pretty healthy. So let's plug their recipe into this nutritional software and see what it spits out. So we have an identified set of criteria that it has to fit within, that it has to have a certain amount of fat, under 700 calories in total for the meal, that kind of thing. Just pretty basic, not really extreme. And so once we have worked with that recipe and get it tweaked, or maybe it already fits within the criteria to begin with, the restaurants are then able to mark that item on their menu as being a healthy choice, as approved by the health department as part of the program Choose Healthy Warren County.
I love to see those little, whether it's a smiley face or a piece of broccoli or whatever the little emoji is or icon next to, or in our house we call them emoji woojies. But then you're drawn to that menu item, because I for myself, I've struggled with weight for a long time. Any of you who have ever met me in person are like, no way. But it's true. I mean, I could easily be addicted to food and be an overeater. And it's, food is one of those things where, like smoking, you could give up, but you have to eat. You have to eat every day. And once you start, you just can't stop. And you look at fried this and fried that, and oh, that big burger and, with all the stuff on top of it. But if I see that little healthy icon, it reminds me that that's the things that me personally, that I should choose.
And I think you're not alone. In our 2010 community health survey that we distributed around the county, people were, they responded that if they saw something like that on a menu, a healthy item that was designated as such, that something like 78% of people would be more likely to order a menu item that they saw labeled with that kind of symbol. And the restaurant owners, I mean, especially I've worked a lot with Jay Chai over at Panin Room in Topo and with Bruno, and they told me from the get-go, when I thought this was going to be a bit of a hard sell for our restaurants, they told me right off the bat, well, this is what our customers are already looking for, so we're happy to work with you. And I think the other key about this program and sort of the other strategies that we're doing in general, the Shaping New Jersey program that's sponsored by the State Health Department in conjunction with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the nonprofit, their tagline is making the healthy choice the easy choice. And that's exactly what we want to do. I mean, the health department is not trying to say you must eat this. These are the rules. It's not that, but it's at least giving you the option of choosing something that you know, someone has already thought about, and this fits into a certain, you know, certain criteria that, you know, it's a healthy thing for you to choose if you want to get away from the fried food every time, which is delicious. I mean, I have no reservations about the fact that.
No, me either.
Everybody loves a fried dish from time to time and a lot of cheese. But it's also good to have a nice healthy option when you go out as well. So we're really excited to be working with this, you know, this public-private partnership, essentially. Bringing in stakeholders from the private sector is a pretty, you know, a relatively new thing in the public health world. And we're really excited to be working on this initiative. And hopefully, you know, you'll be seeing these menus should be marked. We're hoping by the end of June, beginning of July, you should see these printed on the menus. The restaurants have been very cooperative. And so we have an intern from Rutgers, actually, who's working with us, who sits in an office crunching numbers all day on the computer. We're very happy to have her. And you'll see our symbol should be up in the windows, maybe, of the restaurants. And then the menu items will be designated. And look forward to seeing some of the other programs that we've got going on through the rest of the summer season.
Sarah Shoemaker is my guest today on Contours, and she's from the Warren County Health Department. She's the public health planner for the county. And, you know, this so ties in with Warren County to begin with, because we are why they call the Garden State the Garden State.
Amen.
We have the farm stands here. We have every day from now until November, I stop almost every day on my way home at a farm stand just to buy something fresh, whether it's corn on the cob, tomatoes, asparagus this time of year. Why not? I mean, I drive past like four of them between here and my house.
Sure. I think we're very, very lucky in this county to have such a great, vibrant farm community. And actually, I'll be back later in the summer to talk about an event we're holding in September that does involve some of our farms and farmers markets, and about a little pocket guide that we've created as a guide to the farms in Warren County. So I don't want to give it all away, but we do have some other programs that are all tied in with this Choose Healthy program. And you'll see that logo hopefully floating around on the county website, on the Facebook, and we're hoping to promote this via social media. And we even talked with Jim Sheldon. We were thinking about hosting some kind of healthy restaurant event possibly at the end of the summer. So hopefully we can get that together. And if not, maybe next year, because even though our grant, obviously, if you know anything about grants, they're kind of time limited. Our grant period actually only goes to the end of September. But this is a program that Pete Summers, who's the health officer for Warren County, my boss, has been very enthusiastic about this program. And even when our grant funding runs out, we are going to continue this program through the rest. I mean, we're just going to have it as an ongoing program and hopefully get additional restaurants. We'd love to have this go on throughout the entire county, not just in Hackettstown. We're starting in Hackettstown because the restaurants here are fantastic, and our restaurant owners and managers are really wonderful here. But eventually we'd like to expand this countywide. So we're very excited about this program at the health department.
And you should be. This is a great program, and thank you to Rutgers.
Yes, I'd also like to thank our partners at Rutgers Cooperative Extension. So we have Amy Brinton, who works with the SNAP Ed program, and Sherry Sirignano, who is in the Family Community Health Sciences Division. They've been amazing with this whole initiative. And Jim Sheldon has also been very helpful at the Hackettstown bid. And then our restaurants in Hackettstown have just been I can't believe how enthusiastic they've been. So it's really, really exciting for me. And we're excited to see this roll out over the summer and then continue on. So if you eat in the restaurants in Hackettstown, which I hope you do, since many of them are underwriters of yes. WNTI, be on the lookout for your healthy menu items this summer and into the fall.
Fantastic. Now, Sarah, if someone wants to get some information about the Warren County Health Department or wants to contact you about this or I don't know, help in some way, how can they contact you? What's the website?
Sure. The website for the county is www.co.warren.nj.us. And the health department's website is a section of that website. I also referenced our community health improvement plan. I kind of referenced that at the beginning of our interview. And there's a copy of that available online on the health department's section of the county website. And you can view that at your leisure. It's about 30 pages, but it's interesting and looks nice. So I hope you, if you live in Warren County, you might be interested in reading that. And you can also call the health department. And if you want more information about the program, contact me directly. Our number at the health department is 908-475-7960.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. Is there anything else you want the listeners to know about?
I don't think so. I just be on the lookout for our healthy menu items. Hopefully they will be designated on menus printed up by the end of the month, but definitely by July. And we're just very excited about this program. Thank you.
Excellent. We are too. And thank you so much for coming in today. And we will talk again as this program progresses.
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Carl Rickoff for United Astronomy Clubs of New Jersey, bringing you the June astronomy update for the WNTI listening area. They were gathered around a large circle of huge stones. These stones of Stonehenge represented a calendar system. It marks the risings and settings of the sun and the moon on the days of the solstices and equinoxes. On this day, from the middle of this huge stone circle, they watched the sun rise above what is now known as the Heel Stone. This day marked the first day of summer in the Northern Hemisphere, having the longest daylight of the year. Instead of using a stone circle to let us know the first day of summer, we now use telescopes and computers without any celebration or ceremonies. Ah, to return to those good old days. For this year, the first day of summer is June 21 at 12:38 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. With the summer season comes the parade of planets across our night sky. At sunset, Saturn is in Libra toward the south-southeast. Glowing Venus in Cancer and Jupiter in Leo are seen in the west about an hour after sunset. At the end of the month, they'll only be about one-third of a degree apart. Looking east-northeast, Mercury is only a few degrees above the horizon at dawn. Mars is lost in the light of the sun. So you can celebrate the first day of summer and enjoy the alignment of the planets, even without using Stonehenge. Until our next astronomy update, don't forget to check out What's Up in the Night Sky.
That's it for this week's edition of Contours, your weekly roundup of what's happening in the WNTI listening area and the surrounding communities. Thanks to everyone who made today's show possible. Contours is a production of WNTI and can be heard Sundays at 9 a.m. with a rebroadcast on the website wnti.org. If you have a topic you'd like to hear discussed on a future edition of Contours or a comment on today's show, just send me an email, tlm@centenarycollege.edu. That's T-H-I-E-L-M @centenarycollege.edu.